and the triphasic model of trauma, an integrative approach. A Good Omens fanfic written by NNM and performed by Starcatcher Betty. Chapter 5. Cancellation Policy. You have 3 new voice messages. First voice message. Hey, Aubrey, this is Sarah. Sarah Drivera. I know we're scheduled to meet in just a few hours, but something's come up. Don't worry, nothing bad. Actually really good. I hate to do this to you. I feel awful. Anyway, I will definitely be there next week. Okay, bye! Next voice message. Aubrey, this is Matt. I'm not going to be able to make it in today. I understand your cancellation policies, so no worries there. Call me if you need anything from me. Next voice message. Oh my god, you wouldn't believe it. You really wouldn't. Listen, it's like a miracle. A literal miracle. I swear, when I tell you, you won't believe it. But it means I just can't be there today. Just can't make it. I have to cancel. See you next week. Oh, this is Maya. End of new messages. Chapter 6. Attachment Styles. Those who work in helping professions, like therapists, understand the risks. They are subject to burnout. They are subject to compassion fatigue, to vicarious trauma, to finding themselves falling apart at the seams as a result of the constant inundation of other people's needs. It's a risk, a constant risk, that the helper is trained to keep eternally in the back of her mind. How far can I go before I hurt myself? Therapists earn their bread and butter by convincing the broken and disheartened to engage in self-care. Many of them recognize the irony of it. Psychotherapists who specialize in trauma are at special risk. They earn their bread and butter by helping those who have undergone inexpressible horrors to try to express them. They smile. They breathe in deeply. They tear up. They encourage patience and resilience and self-compassion. And they do this all while confronting unimaginable stories of cruelty and abuse, the worst that humans can do to one another, the worst that can be done at all. Their job is to look head on at evil, to acknowledge it, and to find a way to work with it. Aubrey Time always had a knack for that. She was a professional, and she had over 10 years of experience working with cases of severe trauma. 10 years, she knew, was a long tenure for specializing in trauma. She had watched over those years as peers dropped away, dropped out, burnt out, and shriveled up. She would run into them at conferences, and she would see how they laughed softly, without the smile reaching their eyes, and mumble about how they had moved on. She would nod and soothe. She would say she understood, but she did not actually understand. Not really. Aubrey Time had always known she was good at her job. There are tricks and skills that trauma specialists can use to help them avoid, or at least stave off, vicarious trauma for as long as possible. It is a matter of simple compartmentalization. The trauma specialist trains her mind to separate itself into multiple compartments, to keep them apart, to access particularly challenging compartments only when it was professionally or personally appropriate. Keep them hidden, keep them secure, keep all the pain and horror and bile under lock and key until it was safe and appropriate to release it. It was an act of imagination. Aubrey Time had trained herself to compartmentalize by imagining a library cards catalog storage box. She would close her eyes between sessions and visualize it. It had 26 cabinets, each corresponding to a different letter of the alphabet. She kept its contents alphabetized. She would imagine running her fingers over the cold metal pull tabs which opened the drawers. Unlike a regular card catalog, this one had a lock on each drawer. She would imagine the sound the keys would make, turning in the lock. She would imagine the hook on the wall, where she visualized keeping a ring with 26 distinct keys, one for each of the catalog's cabinets. It worked for her. When she felt the need to, she would close her eyes and imagine an empty piece of card paper. She would pick up an imagined pencil, and then she would write whatever she needed to compartmentalize away on that imagined card. She would take the imagined ring of keys off the hook, moving to the appropriate drawer, unlocking it, and filing the card away. She would feel the dusty coolness of all the collected cards stacked in such pleasing order. And then she would close the drawer back up, lock it back up, put the keys back where they belonged. And then she would move on. She kept all the vile horrors she had heard locked up tight, accessible only when she needed them. She could access them when she needed them, and she could ignore them when she needed to. She could keep them cut off, stifled, unobtrusive. Aubrey Time could control them. Her card catalog system had grown more sophisticated and imaginatively solid over time, although it had undergone no major revisions for at least 5 years. Now, however, it did. She put in a new drawer, a 27th one. The new drawer squeezed itself in between C and D. It was the only drawer that had more than a letter on its front. What it said was, Crowley. That's where she would keep it all of it. Everything she knew, everything she felt, all her memories of the deep blue eyes that had felt like burning and drowning, all the shaking and confusion that came from what she could not find within herself to doubt, all the questions that ached viscerally. She stored it all away. She locked it up. She kept it there, locked up, hidden and safe, and thus out of the way. Aubrey Time was a professional, after all, and it was her duty to ensure she could perform her job for her clients without the uncomfortable intrusion of her own personal problems. So she locked them up, and she hid them, and she did her job. She would let them out when it was safe for her to do so. At night, after she had finished her work for the day. On the weekends. During her personal time, she would let that drawer open, and she would let herself feel any number of things, and think any number of things, and respond in any number of ways. She would cope with it all, or at least try to cope with it, or use all the coping techniques she had at her disposal to find a way to live with it. Some of her coping techniques, she knew, were less adaptive than others. She understood this. She accepted this. She was satisfied with this. So long as the results were what she wanted, Aubrey Time could do whatever was necessary, personally, to ensure that she could be who she needed to be professionally. Aubrey Time was a survivor. She was a survivor, and she would do what she had to do in order to survive. She was a professional, and she liked being a professional, and that was why she had always survived. It was 25 minutes before her next session with Crowley was scheduled to start. She decided to leave her office. Her plan was to go outside, go stand in the sun, close her eyes, and visualize the locks and keys on her card catalog. Her plan had been to let the fresh air soothe the headache she hadn't been able to shake all day. That was her plan, 25 minutes before her session with Crowley was scheduled to start, and that was why she had opened the door to her waiting area. She opened the door to her waiting area 25 minutes beforehand, and she saw that he was already there. "You're early," she said, standing in her doorway, feeling at sea. "No," he said, cool and collected, not shifting one bit in response to her presence. "I'm just not late." He had never been early before. Not that she knew, at least. She saw him. She saw that he was sitting. He was not sprawling, not slouching, not reclining, but sitting, like any normal human would. He was holding in his lap a copy of Better Homes and Gardens that had occupied her waiting area's coffee table for at least 3 years. His head was angled down, as one would expect from someone reading a magazine. She couldn't find within herself the ability to believe he was actually reading it. Usually, when he wore his sunglasses, he used his brow and head angle to compensate, to let her know where he was looking. He did that, at least, when he wanted her to know. Apparently, right now, he didn't. It was possible that he had shifted his eyes to watch her, but he gave no indication that he had done so. He looked like a human reading a magazine. "Well," she said, because she could think of nothing else to say, "I'll see you in 25 minutes." He gave no reply. There was nothing else to do about it. She stepped back into her office, and she shut the door again. 25 minutes she had to spend waiting. She took several deep breaths. She dry swallowed 2 aspirin. She rubbed at her temples. She was not prepared, and she would not be prepared. And he was already there, in her waiting area, conspicuously just not late. On her desk, she had a pad of sticky notes. She sat down and collected it. She also collected a pen, and then she sat for several long minutes, looking at the empty yellow note. She would write herself a reminder. Not the kind of reminder that was alphabetized away, hidden away, so it could do no harm. Instead, it would be the kind of reminder that she needed to keep real and tangible. She wrote, "He's a person." Afterwards, she adhered the sticky note to the inside wall of her desk drawer. She would keep it there, safe and secure. It would be accessible there whenever she found herself in need of it. When she sat in her chair during a session, she would be able to glance over to it to remind herself it was there. After 25 minutes had passed, she stood, opened the door, and invited him in. "Ground rules," she said, once he was seated. "For what?" he asked. He was, again, sitting, and it was unsettling. He looked uncomfortable. "For everything," she said, making a broad gesture of the room. "All of this." "Aha," he said, and he nodded. He understood. She thought she saw him start to lean back to get into his comfortable sprawl, but then he stopped himself. "What do you have in mind?" "Actually, let's start with you," she said, because she had anticipated that response. Beyond that, though, she was not sure. She was not sure what he would say, what ground rules he would need or find acceptable, how the dynamic between them would be different or the same. She felt unprepared, and she hated feeling unprepared, and she was working to keep it hidden. "Now that I know what I know," she faltered, lost her pace. She was annoyed at herself for falling into euphemisms, and she was annoyed, equally, that she couldn't quite bring herself to rephrase it. "Is there anything you think you need from me?" "Well," he said, too quickly for him to actually take in her question seriously, "exorcisms are right out." She put on a grim look. "They don't even work on this body, but they're really annoying." "You're making a joke of this," she said. "No, I'm not," he said in a side-out kind of way, in the kind of way that meant, "I was, but I'll stop now." Again, she saw him twitch a little, as if he wanted to sprawl out, but stopped himself from doing so. "No holy water. Don't bring any holy water in here." He wasn't joking anymore, but the words made her feel like laughing. Aubrey Time was not someone who had ever interacted, either professionally or personally, with holy water. "I think I can manage that." "I'm serious," he said, and he sounded like it.
Right. Okay.
So that was another thing to file away. Holy water was real, and it was serious.
What else?
He tapped his fingers on the arm of his chair. He made a collection of I'm thinking faces. Oh, don't use his name.
He has a name?
Huh? I didn't know he even had a name. Of course he has a name. Who doesn't have a name? I thought he didn't. She was confused. He looked annoyed.
So, what should I call him?
It doesn't matter, so long as it's not his name. The evil one, Prince of Darkness, the massive prick, whatever.
Wait.
What?
You're talking about...
She pointed downwards.
Him?
Now he looked confused. Who did you...
She pointed upwards. Crowley followed the line made by her finger, and then he hissed out,
Oh, for Earth's sake.
He lifted his glasses enough to rub at his eyes, and he shook his head.
No, Herb, no. She has a name, too, but I don't think you know it.
She?
Mm-hmm.
Really?
She? Yep.
Huh.
Aubrey Time thought about that, but then she thought about it some more. She found she had a lot to think about that, especially within her professional capacities.
You really did work with Freud, didn't you?
Don't you dare, he warned, now scowling at her. But it was a friendly scowl. Ground rules.
Right.
She accepted that. She got it. She shouldn't have let that question out at all, she recognized. Okay, let's get back on track. Anything else? He shrugged. He looked off to the side, and then he turned back to look at her. He made it very clear that he was looking at her. You doing all right? He asked. He asked it like a concerned friend, but he was not her concerned friend. He was her client. He asked it like she might not be all right, like she would tell him if she wasn't, but she wouldn't.
Thank you for your concern, she said, and she smiled.
She said it like a professional, and she smiled like a professional, because that's what she was. Any other ground rules you need? He said, sounding thoughtful, sounding unsatisfied. He was still looking at her. He looked, not like he was judging her, but like he was making judgments about her. She didn't like that. How's the tree? Of course he would ask about the tree. Of course he would. The tree was a goddamned annoyance. Aubrey Time did not care about the tree. She did not care about plants, either professionally or personally, and she had no interest in trying to keep things like trees or flowers or vines alive. This tree, in particular, was both a professional and personal nuisance. It was, in her mind, Aziraphale's tree, not hers. If Crowley thought of it the same way, there'd be hell to pay when she inevitably killed it. And it would take hard work to make that into a therapeutically valuable experience for him.
Looks like it's doing fine, she said simply.
It would do better if you moved it over by the window, he said, and he even gestured towards the window, as if she needed a reminder about where it was located. Not enough sunlight where it is now.
This reminded her that he was a gardener, that he liked plants. She knew he kept a garden, and she knew that he was deeply proud of it. She knew how proud of it was, because he never mentioned it without insulting it. I'll keep that in mind, she said, stifling her desire to chuck the damned tree out the window. Back to our ground rules.
It's just, you know, I feel responsible for it, he said. She wanted him to shut up about the damned tree. She wanted him to move off the subject. She also wanted to get back to the ground rules because she had some very important points to raise. But even more, she wanted to understand why he had just cut her off to say this, of all things. Crowley, she well knew by this point,
almost never accepted responsibility for anything. "It's the way it is because of me, isn't it?" he went on. He tilted his head to the side and he was looking at her, and she was growing so annoyed with him because he was still sitting and not sprawling. "I did that to it. My responsibility. I take responsibility for it." Aubrey Time knew her job. She knew exactly how she should respond to what he was saying. She knew the precise therapeutic move to make, given what he had just said, given the way he had emphasized the words "my" and "take." She knew what she should say was, "This isn't about the tree, Crowley, is it?" She should put him on the spot. She should make him acknowledge that he was talking in code. But she wouldn't do it. She wouldn't ask that question. Because then she suspected he would put her on the spot. And she couldn't have that. "My tree," she said. "My responsibility." He didn't respond, beyond a clack noise he made with his tongue. At least he finally scooted down a little in the seat, into a half sprawl. "Tell me your ground rules, Aubrey Time." She paused to take a deep breath. She closed her eyes just momentarily so she could take the card out, on which she had written "the damn tree," down and put it back where it belonged, in her card catalog, and lock it up nice and tight, where it would be safely out of her attention until she had the time and energy to deal with it. After 10 years of experience, she was good at doing this. She could do it quickly, looking barely like she had done more than taken a long blink, and her client would not even know. Aubrey Time was a professional. "Okay, Crowley," she said, mostly to buy herself time. "Look, let's start with this." She was uncertain. This felt like dangerous ground. "What did you do to my other clients?" He raised an eyebrow. He opened his mouth to speak. She couldn't remember if his teeth had always looked that sharp. "Nothing bad," he said. "Crowley." Maybe she felt sick. She was a professional. "Nothing bad," he repeated, more emphatically. "Look, you were in no shape to see other clients last week. Would you have preferred they all just showed up? I took care of things." "That was a violation of federal law," she said, with significance, with feeling. She felt her nostrils flare. She felt her lips twitch. "Is that what you care about?" He sounded surprised, unimpressed. "I also didn't drop by customs when I popped over here today. You worried about that, too?" She wasn't gritting her teeth. They weren't clattering. She was a professional, and this mattered. "You leave my other clients alone." Something flicked across his face. A quick expression. Something that looked like rage. But then it was gone, and his face was still. "I did not hurt them, Aubrey. I wouldn't do that." There were a number of different potential responses available to her. None of them, however, would have been professional. None of them had therapeutic merit. "Ground rules," she said. "Leave my other clients alone." He looked like he, too, had a number of different responses available to him. "Fine," he said. "Not a problem. Don't worry about it." 3 times, she noticed. He agreed to it 3 times. "Thank you," she said. She nodded at him. She felt too tired to smile. Her headache hadn't gone away. She watched as he bit at the side of his cheek, giving no response. She acknowledged to herself that she should check in with him, ask about how he was feeling. She should ask about that expression she had seen on his face. She should admit that she felt uncertain and even a little scared. She should be willing to say the word demon. Aubrey Time was very capable of recognizing the many things she should be doing. Okay, she said. One more thing. You up for one more thing? Fine, he said, although he didn't mean it. 3 sessions ago, she said to start. She wasn't comfortable. She felt her lip twitch again. You did something to my clock, didn't you? Aubrey Time knew her client, Crowley, fairly well at this point. She knew how to observe him. She knew that he thought best when he could move, the physical activity freeing up his mind. She knew that their therapeutic alliance was the strongest when he was willing to throw petty insults at her. And she knew it was at its most frayed when he grew slow, when he stilled, when he sat silently tense. Over the past week, Aubrey Time had found herself reading up on herpetology. She hadn't felt that any of it was useful at the time, but now, as she watched her client, Crowley, she could not help but compare the intensity of his motionless posture to the images and videos she had seen. What if I had? He said, finally. That's unacceptable, she said. Unacceptable? He repeated, and there was an edge to it, an edge that felt dangerous. It was an edge she had heard in his voice before, and it was something she normally would have paid very close attention to. Normally, she would have done something about it, made sure he was aware of it, helped him through it. But not now. Not about this. Unacceptable, she said, and it was like a foot coming down. I didn't do anything to your clock, he said. He was angry. She could see that he was angry. She had a headache, and she was tired, and she wanted to get home so she could cope, but she could see how angry she had made him, and she could also hear him the way he sounded as he was angry, and the way he sounded out the words, to your clock, and it made her remember that Crowley was a liar. Let me rephrase that, she said, squinting shut her eyes, letting herself think. Did you do anything to me, or to this room, or to anything that led us spending less than a total of 50 minutes working together 3 sessions ago? It doesn't matter, he said. It does, she said. It doesn't matter, he repeated, like saying it could make it true. It couldn't. You interfered with our work. No, I didn't. He was a liar. Aubrey Time was angry. She could acknowledge to herself that she was angry. She was angry in the middle of a session with a client who was also angry. She was viciously angry. She was spitting angry, biting angry, raging angry. She felt like kicking in his 2 sharp teeth. We work in 50-minute increments, Crowley, she said. That's what we agreed to when you first came here, and you interfered with that. She had a headache, and she was tired, and she needed a chance just to cope. But even a therapist who is tired and aching is able to understand anger. Aubrey Time had always understood anger. Anger was, after all, what so many trauma survivors thrive in and through. She understood that anger works as a mask for other emotions, deeper and more vital emotions. Anger masks shame. It masks fear. It masks sorrow. Aubrey Time may not have felt well, but she understood that she was angry, and she understood that anger functions as a mask for shame and fear and sorrow. She refused to interrogate which of those 3 options her current anger was masking. Fine, he said, or rather he spat. He sneered at her, and it wasn't a friendly sneer. It was an angry sneer, because he was just as angry as she was. No, she reconsidered. He was angrier than she was. He was angry because anger masks shame and fear and sorrow. He was angrier than she was because in this instant he had far more to lose than she did. "I get it," he spat out again, and he pushed himself out of his seat and he sneered again. And then he was off, stomping, and he was storming his way out of the door. He was gone. He had stormed out and he had left in the middle of their session, and her office was empty. 1 second. She sat across from the empty seat, her whole body thrumming. 2 seconds. She breathed in. 3 seconds. She decided if he wasn't back in 15 minutes, she would call him. 4 seconds. And he was back. He stormed back into the room with the same amount of explosive energy as he had left with. He pushed himself back into his seat. He sat, hunched over, hands clutching each other between his knees. He didn't even look at her. He was looking instead at the floor between them. She estimated 4 seconds seemed like enough time for him to storm his way to the edge of her waiting area and then storm back. It did not, however, seem like enough time for him to storm out, pause to reconsider, and then storm back. He hadn't had to think about it. He had never planned on going farther than he needed to prove his point. It had simply been a test, a trial run. It wasn't a test of leaving. She was certain he needed no practice to do that. He had left, and then he had turned, and he had tested whether he could come back. He had been angry. She had been angry. She had called his behavior unacceptable, and still, he had been able to come back. By this point in the relationship, they were very good at sitting in silence with one another. It had lost its awkwardness long ago. They both had substantial experience sitting with each other's breaths. They could sit with one another in silence as they calmed. "I'm glad you came back," she said. She meant it. He didn't respond. He kept looking at the floor between them. He was still, but not like before. The taut anxiety was gone. There was a quietude to his stillness. He sucked on his teeth like he was thinking. "I probably wasn't ready for this yet," she said. She considered tacking on, "I'm sorry," but she decided against it. Now was not a time to push him. She already had, and she hadn't been very conscientious about it. It wasn't what either of them needed, not right now. What they both needed right now was to do something else entirely. "Have I ever told you," he asked, sounding cautious, "how Aziraphale and I met?" She smiled. She couldn't help it. His wording was charming. He had not said, "let me tell you." He had not said, "you really should know." He had not said, "I really want to say this." He had instead used such a casual wording, the sort of wording that works for an anecdote between friends, like a story told and retold 100 times at one's favorite bar. He chose his wording, even though there was absolutely no way either of them could think he ever had told her before about how he and Aziraphale had met. He chose this wording because he understood it was what both of them needed. "No," she said, still offering her smile. "I don't believe you have. I'd love to hear it." "Okay," he said. He looked up at her, and he smiled back. He leaned back for the first time that day, and she watched him sprawl out in his chair as if he had never learned what it was meant to sit. "This was right after the apple," he said as a start, and then he kept going. It was a good story, a sweet one, the way he told it, although it was not artfully told. Aubrey Time realized that this could quite possibly be the first time he had ever told it to anyone. She wondered about that, about what to make of it, about what 6,000 years of holding in all of one's stories could feel like. She wondered what Aziraphale's version of the story would be like. She wondered all of this, but she also listened. She gave him her attention. Her head hurt, and she was tired, and she desperately needed to cope. But she could give him her attention. This was a story that mattered to him, and it was something she could cherish, for his sake. He told stories for the rest of the session. They were true stories, stories about him, about Aziraphale. They were, all of them, easy stories. There was no pain. Or if there was, he skipped over it. There were hard stories he would have to tell in the future. There were stories he would have to tell, filled with pain and cruelty, and there would be therapeutic work for them to do with those stories. But these stories were different. These were not stories for them to do therapeutic work with, but instead through. Crowley told her stories, and that was how they learned to inhabit their new normal. Chapter 7. Dual Relationships. All right. Okay. She looked down at the pad of paper that she held in her lap. She had a pen in one hand so she could write notes. Bear with me. I'm trying to make sense of all this. Take your time, he said, lazy and a little bored. He was leaning back in his chair, looking up at the ceiling. His posture would have satisfied Freud. You lost the Antichrist. The nuns lost the Antichrist, best as I can figure. How do you lose an Antichrist? You'd have to ask the nuns. You had the Antichrist in a basket, backseat of my car. You delivered the Antichrist, put him in the nuns' hands myself. And then you lost him. The nuns lost him. So, how did the nuns lose him? I could have done more, I guess. She understood. Since she had put responsibility on the nuns, it was safe now for him to acknowledge his own role in it all. Should have stayed with him the whole time. I could have impersonated a doctor, handed him over to the right parents myself. That's what a proper demon would have done. They had been working for several weeks now on Crowley's trauma narrative. The process was slow, at times frustrating, and always downright confounding. He insisted that all of it was true, and she mostly believed him. He insisted that all of it had occurred within her own lifetime, that she must have been aware of some of it at the time. She just couldn't remember it. Almost no one, apparently, could. He wasn't lying, but it was a lot to take in. For most of their time working together, Aubrey Time had assumed that the trauma narrative would focus around a single event, a fire, which had lasted at most a few hours. The more that Crowley talked, however, the more she realized it was far more complex than that. There had been an entire week of events which could have all, individually, been significant traumas, with a preceding 11 years of relevant buildup. It literally had been the end of the world, and Crowley had played a starring role in it, and that sort of thing just wasn't easy to live through. Sometimes she would go back and review all of her old notes, from back before she knew what she now knew. She was starting to realize just how rarely he had ever actually lied. They had titled the book they were writing as a conceit to help him process through his trauma narrative. Crowley's first draft for a title had been Anthony's Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Week. She had suggested he try again. His second attempt was The Bitter Edge Whence We Teetered. So she had pressed him to take a third stab at it. The more they worked on the book, the more Aubrey Time came to recognize the pattern to how he described things. He would oscillate between the juvenile and the sublime. He would suggest either the most immature and simplistic descriptions of things, or he would lapse, without any apparent difficulty, into literal poetry. She teased him once that he was going to assume Shakespeare had been his pen name, and he hadn't been amused. It took effort for both of them, for him to find a form of expression that was both straightforward and descriptive. The title they finally agreed to was When the World Didn't End. After the title had been established, they moved on to the table of contents. The table of contents for Crowley's book was 1. An unwanted honor. 2. 11 years together. 3. No dog. 4. No leads. 5. The bandstand. 6. A big mess. 7. The fire. 8. After the fire. 9. My Bentley. 10. The kid's all right. 11. Redacted. 12. The Ritz. 13. Retirement. This was longer than she usually wanted a trauma narrative to be. 5 chapters, from her perspective, would have been better. But she had to admit that there were more than 5 chapters worth of significant events for him to describe. At first, she had assumed that he had added a redacted chapter just to ensure that there were 13 chapters in total. He had assured her, however, that there was a real chapter that belonged there, that he cared deeply about it, and that he could not share it with her. He had assured her it was a matter of life and death that he tell no one, especially not a human that both sides could recognize had an association with him. He had assured her, if it were anything less than his and Aziraphale's and her own safety at risk, he would tell her what it was. She had believed him. She hadn't pressed. She had filed those assurances away in a card catalog where they belonged, and she didn't pay attention to anything she might feel about the reasoning he had given. She still had headaches all the time. She went through aspirin too quickly. She was tired too much. She hated her tree. She kept all that to herself, of course. She kept it all filed away. She let herself cope with it on her own personal time, and she made sure her coping did not interfere with her professional responsibilities. She got better at staying focused while at work, despite the aches and exhaustion. Aubrey Time did her job. Okay, hold up. She put the pen down, resting it against the notepad. This was how she signaled that they were about to go on a tangent. I think we should talk about that. Uh-huh, he said in resignation, not agreement. Proper, she repeated, although she probably should have repeated the whole phrase he had used. She wasn't going to do that, though.
That's what I said.
You're not proper? He tilted his head upright so he could look at her.
What do you think? She knew what she thought.
I'm asking you.
Of course I'm not a proper demon.
And how do you feel about that?
He made a complicated, multi-note groan.
All that, huh? She said, dry. How about this? Take me back to the moment where you found out the Antichrist was missing.
He made a different, equally complicated groan.
What were you thinking right then?
I was thinking, we're all fucked, we're all going to die, the world is ending.
Right. Yep. That hadn't been a surprise. That, she had learned as they worked on the book, was a distraction, a stalling tactic. What were you thinking about yourself?
I was thinking lots of things.
So, let's go through them.
Now that it's all done and over, of course, I think it all went down exactly as she wanted it to.
She had asked for his contemporaneous judgments, and he hadn't provided that. But she was also very interested whenever he made references to her. It was annoying just how good he was at offering distractions. Is that a good thing? He thought about that.
Not sure. Can't say.
His lips twitched just slightly downwards. He leaned back so he was looking upwards again.
Or, well, it's her, so of course it's good. Couldn't be otherwise.
You really believe that? She asked, because she was surprised. Because she couldn't believe that Crowley, of all people, had started to sound a little starstruck.
Eh, he said. She decided she wasn't going to push the issue.
Not now. Back then, day of the... She paused to check her notes. The birthday party? You learned the Antichrist was missing. What did you think about yourself?
I thought... He started.
He was looking upwards, still not at her, but she could see how his jaw was working. She could see the fingers on his hands curl inwards, the fingernails scraping against the fabric of his chair's armrest. He was working himself up to being honest. It was always a physical process for him.
I thought, he repeated before going on. His voice was quiet. I ruin everything I touch.
She let out a heavy breath, like the sound of being punched. That was how she expected it must have felt for him to say that out loud.
Ouch, she said. Eh, he said, or rather mumbled, as if she could take back the honesty he had just given.
He raised a hand up and made a waving gesture, as if trying to brush his words out of the air around him. It hurts to think things like that, she said, because it was true. Because clients like Crowley often needed to be reminded of things that were true. But the fact that we think it doesn't make it true.
He didn't respond.
Is it true? She asked. She wanted to hear him give the answer. Give the true answer. She wanted him to hear him give the answer.
Ugh, he said. He made another waving gesture, as if it was now her question that he wanted to remove from the air around him.
Scale of 1 to 10, she pushed. How true is it that you ruin everything you touch? He was still and quiet, head facing up for a full 10 seconds. Then he breathed in deep and repositioned himself. He moved to a more upright position, his more usual sprawl. She saw that his face was slack with some deep emotion, like concern. He was looking at her.
1 to 10, she repeated, quiet. Her head was aching. You can prove me wrong, you know.
He said it like he was imploring.
Aziraphale, she replied, quick and ready. Too quick and ready. She should have pushed him again to tell her where his beliefs fell on the scale. She shouldn't have risen to his bait, accepting his test. But the look on his face was making her feel very tired, or something like tired. And she didn't want to try to think through why he had said what he had said, what it could be code for, what he was trying to get her to understand. There was nothing he could be saying that she needed to understand.
He doesn't count.
Of course he counts, she said, now letting herself feel annoyed rather than tired. You can't discount evidence just because it goes against your hypotheses.
He smiled at her. It was a sad smile. It was a meaningful smile, or at least, a smile that looked like he had meant it to be meaningful. She refused to explore its meaning. She couldn't let herself explore its meaning. Aubrey Time was a professional. She was also a human, and she was going through a rough time personally. She was putting a lot of time into coping where she was at home, on her own time, but not at work. She did not let her coping interfere with her professional responsibilities. She was careful. She was in control. And so, there was nothing that her client Crowley could be trying to say to her. There was nothing he could know about her personal time that he could be trying to talk to her about, trying to say with all that fucking sad smile of his. There was nothing to it. "It's not too late, Herb," he said, and he was quiet, and he was sad. And she needed to be on her own so she would be able to cope, because he was making her need to cope. "Just prove me wrong," he implored. "I think we should do something different today," he said as he was sitting down. He said it with a confident, casual tone, which made her understand that this was something he had planned. "And what's that?" she asked, ready to humor him. "I think you should screen me." He nodded, satisfied with his plan. He slapped his hands against his chair's armrest. "Alcoholism. Screen me for alcoholism." "Really?" She was surprised. They had spoken about his alcohol consumption in the past, and he had been quite clear that he was satisfied with his habits. "Has something changed recently, or, well, you know, better safe than sorry," he said, with a too casual nod to his head. "Isn't alcoholism a pretty common response to traumatic experiences? That's what I read, at least." Anthony J. Crowley, that petulant, childish, rebellion shaped like a man, son of a bitch, was sitting across from her, and he had just admitted to reading. She pressed her tongue against one of her canines, watching him as he watched her. Aubrey Time did not want to screen him for alcohol use disorder. Aubrey Time did not want to screen anyone for alcohol use disorder. Aubrey Time did not want to think about alcohol use disorder. "Come on," he said, and there was something of an undercurrent to his tone. "It'll be fun." "It wouldn't be fun. Alcohol use disorder screenings are not fun." "No one thought they were fun." The way he said it, he certainly did not actually expect it to be fun. He said it like a dare, or maybe a taunt. She didn't like that. She crossed one leg over the other, shifting in her seat, and she rested her chin on her hand. He won. "How many nights a week, would you say, do you drink?" He said, as if he were dissatisfied with the question, as if this wasn't exactly what he had just asked for. He sounded like his plan wasn't going the way he wanted. She didn't like that he had a plan. "Shouldn't you have a checklist or something?" "That comes later." "No, I'd really like for us to have a checklist." He clicked his tongue against his teeth a few times, as if thinking, and then he started swiveling his head, looking around her office. "Someone as devout as you surely must have a Bible around here somewhere." She raised an eyebrow at him. "Ah, there it is," he said, apparently spotting what he wanted. He tumbled out of his seat in a way that somehow led him to being fully upright, and he moved over to her bookshelf by her desk. She didn't like him interacting with her bookshelf, or her books, or any of her things, really, but she did nothing to stop him. He reached and he pulled Diagnostic and Statistic Manual of Mental Disorders, 5th edition, from her shelf. The DSM doesn't provide an assessment to screen for alcohol use disorder. There are plenty of screening tools available, and she could have pointed him to where she kept the ones she used, but she didn't. This was his plan, his game, so she'd let him play by his rules. "Right," he said, sitting back down, the DSM in his lap. He started flipping through it,
Alcohol. He frowned, looking up at her. How is this not in alphabetical order?
She snorted out a laugh. Page 48. It's somewhere around there.
He nodded and flipped to that page. Substance-related and addictive disorders.
He read out the title.
Sounds about right, doesn't it?
She could tell he was starting to read through the page. At this rate, it would take him all day to find what he wanted.
She held out a hand. Give it to me.
No, he said, and he pulled the DSM closer to himself. This was his game, and he was going to play it by his rules.
I'll find it.
You're several pages off. Just look for the heading, Alcohol Use Disorder.
He said as he followed her advice. There we go. Alcohol-related disorders. Alcohol use disorder, right under it. Now, why not just call it alcoholism, I wonder?
She shrugged. There were reasons, but she could tell he wasn't actually interested.
All right, he said, settling in, cradling the heavy book in his lap.
She couldn't imagine it was pleasant reading such a technical text while wearing sunglasses.
Diagnostic criteria, he read out, and then he looked up at her to see if she was paying attention.
She showed that she was. She also showed that she was not amused.
A problematic pattern of alcohol use leading to clinically significant impairment or distress, as manifested by at least two of the following occurring within a 12-month period.
He paused there. He looked up at her.
So we're looking for at least two problems within the last year.
Clinically significant problems, she clarified.
He said, sounding dissatisfied. He went back to reading. One, alcohol is often taken in larger amounts or over a longer period than was intended.
He looked up at her.
Well?
What do you think that would be like?
He asked. He asked it like he wanted her to imagine it, and she really wasn't amused.
You tell me,
she said.
He kept on looking at her for a few more seconds, but he didn't respond. He turned back to the book.
Two, there is a persistent desire or unsuccessful efforts to cut down or control alcohol use. Now that one's not relevant,
he judged without even pausing, as if it were obvious.
Three, a great deal of time is spent in activities necessary to obtain alcohol, use alcohol, or recover from its effects. Now this one is interesting, wouldn't you say?
He looked back up at her.
Why did you say that?
She asked.
What do you think counts as a great deal of time?
What do you think?
Well, how would I know? He asked. And there was a feigned innocence to the question that put her teeth on edge. I'd need a comparison, wouldn't I? Can't tell if you're putting a great deal of time into something unless you know how much time others put into it, can you?
She didn't respond. Her head was still propped up by her hand. She still wasn't amused.
So, give me a comparison, Herb.
He tilted his head, just slightly, to indicate how closely he was looking at her.
How about yourself?
He asked, and he asked it like it was an idea that just popped into his head. Clearly it wasn't, and she was getting pissed off.
Tell me how much time you spend in activities necessary to obtain alcohol, use alcohol, or recover from its effects.
She didn't respond.
Just so I can use it as a comparison,
he said, cool and calm. Too cool and calm.
That's all.
Weren't people always getting into trouble playing games by a demon's rules? Shouldn't she have recognized that much earlier?
What's this about?
She asked, and her voice was dark. She repositioned herself, sitting up straighter. She was poised to strike if necessary.
We're just checking to see if I've developed alcohol use disorder, aren't we?
His voice was so simple, so saccharine and innocent, and his expression was so perfectly innocent, as if he were hiding nothing, as if there was nothing below the surface, as if he weren't daring her to see right through him.
Just part of your professional duties, isn't it? Making sure your client hasn't developed any self-destructive tendencies.
What is this about, Anthony? She insisted, feeling now even darker. He kept looking at her. He kept staring at her. His jaw worked, and she recognized the way his jaw was working, because it was working the way it used to, when he couldn't tell her the truth. When there were too many things left unsaid. When he was navigating conversations they couldn't actually have.
You tell me.
He laid those words out in the space between them, low and thick, and they affected her like shears cutting through too tight wire. She felt it, the rise of a burning anger that she had been ignoring, denying, hiding away since he first mentioned alcoholism. She hissed in a breath through clenched teeth, and she felt like sneering.
You keeping tabs on me? She asked. No, accused.
What?
He looked taken aback, and it was less than he deserved.
You following me?
Of course not, he said, and he had the audacity to look askance, to look like she was the one who had offended him.
Bullshit. She said, "This is bullshit. Whatever you think you're doing, you have no right."
"What I think I'm doing?" he repeated.
"It's called stalking," she felt like growling.
"It's a complete violation. It is..."
He cut her off with a deep, shocked laugh. He laughed. He laughed at her. He shook his head with that laugh, a laugh that said, "I can't believe you're such an idiot." And it was precisely the sort of laugh that got the words, "Get out of my office and never return," ready on her lips. But before she could let them out, he was taking off his sunglasses. He took off his sunglasses and he looked her straight in the eye, and there was a kindness to his eyes, a sweetness to them, which made her realize she had misinterpreted his laugh.
"I'm not stalking you, Aubrey," he said.
And he was honest. It was the kind of honesty that was calming. It was stabilizing. She hated it. She hated that it worked. She leaned back a little in her chair.
"I wouldn't do that."
He closed the DSM in his lap. His interest in it completely dissolved. He discarded it on the end table beside his chair.
"It would be a complete violation. You're right. Which is why I wouldn't do that."
She had to admit, she knew that about him.
"It's just,
don't you get it?" He looked off to the side as if he was trying to think. Then he turned back to her and he leaned forward in his chair.
"I may be retired, but I have over 6,000 years of experience under my belt, Aubrey."
He paused to give her a chance to respond. She didn't.
"I invented humanity's self-destructive tendencies. You think I can't spot them?"
That felt like a wound, and she was working hard to keep it from showing.
"You think I can't tell when I inspired them?"
He was waiting again for her to respond. She breathed in deeply, and then she breathed out. She felt very tired, and she had a headache. And she needed to cope, and that was exactly what he was forcing her to think about.
"Crowley," she said, soft but firm.
The good news was she had a script to follow for this sort of thing. She had never experienced this precisely, but close enough. She could follow the script.
"Thank you for your concern. This relationship between us
is a really important one, and I take your concern to show just how much the work we are doing in here matters for you. But let's be very clear. It is a professional relationship between us.
Yep,
he nodded in complete, ready agreement.
That's right. This is professional.
That wasn't part of the script. When she had to give this speech to a client, he was supposed to look a bit sad or hurt, a bit ashamed, and then they could process through that. He wasn't supposed to be so perfectly acquiescent. She narrowed her eyes at him. She had the suspicion that this wasn't part of his original plan. He had come in here with a plan, or perhaps, more likely, half a plan, and trust in his ability to improvise. Then, improvise he had. He had shifted his approach, easy as water flowing downhill. He was working, and she could identify competency when she saw it. It is very hard to dispute someone, she could feel, when all they did was agree with you.
We're talking right now, one professional to another,
he said, so cool and calm, so reasonably, so competently. She had to remind herself what they were talking about. It was something she didn't want to talk about. It was something that had no professional significance. It was something that had no bearing on his therapeutic work, and so it was the sort of thing that should not be raised in this professional setting. It was against her code of ethics, her professional code of ethics, her personal code of ethics, to let her personal problems into the therapeutic setting. My personal life is my personal life, she said.
Well, you see, he gave a little half wince, the kind of wince that said, would love to help you out, but rules are the rules. That's the thing. Know how you have a professional interest in my personal life? How we spend all our time in here talking about all sorts of private, intimate details about me, because that's what allows you to do your job?
He wanted her to respond, to agree, because that's how someone gets walked into a trap. She stayed quiet.
My job is the same way, he went on. I have a professional interest in the personal lives of those who are currently in the process of self-destruction.
Aubrey Tyne was a professional psychotherapist. She did her job and she did it well. She was career-oriented. She had always been career-oriented. When he said self-destruction, it felt like a blow to the chest. You're retired, she said. He shrugged.
Do you think you'll stop being a professional when you retire, Aubrey Tyne?
She felt heavy and out of sorts and completely unprepared for everything that was going on. She wanted to return to feeling angry, as she had felt earlier. It would be easier if she could be angry. It would be easier if he would just stop saying things that were true.
All I'm asking, he said, carefully, precisely, is for you to take care of yourself so you actually make it to the age of retirement.
She wasn't an idiot. She understood. She did not specialize in substance use treatment, but she understood it. She had a professional's understanding of the relationship between trauma and the propensity for substance abuse. She had a professional's understanding of how alcohol abuse progressed and how it affected the human body and how it could completely destroy someone, even if that someone would never let it destroy her career. It wasn't as if she had been unaware. It wasn't as if she cared, so long as she had her career. It wasn't as if she knew any other goddamned way to cope. We should call it quits for the day, she said. She felt like slumping over in her chair. She felt robbed of her professional capacities. She felt bereft. He turned his head and looked at the clock. He did it very pointedly.
He could be a real asshole.
We work in 50-minute increments, he said.
I'm no use to you today. You...
She was about to say, you've ruined me.
She hoped he couldn't tell.
You've worn me out.
So let's just talk, he said with a shrug, with a gesture of his hands that said, here is what I have to offer.
Talk to me, Herb.
No, she said. It wasn't a rejection. It had no bite. It wasn't a demand. It was just ground rules.
One professional to another.
He tried again. He looked at her, hopeful, kind. He wanted to help. He was offering an alternative set of ground rules. All she had to do was accept. All she had to do was give in, to forget that it went against her ethical code, that it was wrong. All she had to do was let him do his job.
No, she repeated.
Her professionalism was her shield, but it was more than that. It was all she had. The Second World War left psychologists and sociologists with a mighty big question. The sort of question that can get funded with grants. The sort of question that leads to interesting and publishable explorations of moral psychology. The question was this. Just what the hell was wrong with ordinary Germans? There was an assumption, a very easy assumption, a comforting assumption, an assumption any of us would make in the right circumstances, that something must have been wrong with all of those ordinary Germans. They went along with evil, after all. They applauded Hitler. They had turned in their neighbors. They had participated in genocide. It is so very hard to imagine how anyone could do that, how anyone could agree to murder and torture, how anyone could excuse others for murder and torture as well. After the Second World War, plenty of researchers sat and looked at the evidence available, and they tried to determine how something like the Holocaust could ever occur. One classic text that came out of this research was The Authoritarian Personality. It suggested that some people are just psychologically predisposed to fascism. It was a personality trait. The willingness to follow authorities, and it just so happened that Germany was filled to the brim with people who had this personality trait. The book was wrong. Offensive, really. Ordinary Germans, even during the Holocaust, were just that. Ordinary. 70 years of empirical social psychology later, that every introductory psychology student enjoys learning about, and we have come to understand that, really, there is nothing special about the capacity for evil. It is, in fact, extremely easy to get a human to go against her moral code, to do what she believes to be wrong. It doesn't require temptation. It doesn't require a supernatural entity whispering in one's ear. It just requires the right set of circumstances. The right set of external conditions. It is almost as if we had had the capacity within us all along, the capacity to do evil, as if it was built into us from some original blueprint. Aubrey Time didn't believe in evil. Or perhaps she did. It was complicated. But she did believe in social psychology. She believed in the empirical sciences. She believed in the Milgram's experiment's results, even if she would never have performed such experiments herself, or if, at least, she would not want to find herself willing to perform such experiments. She believed in the power of compassion and understanding, and she believed that, perhaps, the best way to avoid ever committing evil was by working to understand it. That led to it. How it was motivated, and how it was a perfectly natural, perfectly human response to certain types of circumstances. Aubrey Time believed, or at least she attempted to believe, that the best way to avoid going against one's own moral code was simply to avoid the types of circumstances that would lead to one doing so.
Getting a human to do what she believes to be wrong doesn't require appealing to her base instincts. You don't have to flash all her heart's desires before her. You merely have to provide the hint of an expectation. You merely have to suggest that, perhaps, there is no reasonable alternative. And it is easiest of all, really, when the human is already scared and alone, needy, at wit's end, confused and addled. 3 weeks. They continued working on his trauma narrative. It was slow work. They were going very slowly. It was appropriate for this work to go slowly. 3 weeks, and every session he gave her this certain type of look. Like he knew. Like he knew that she knew. Like all he had to do was wait. Crowley, she started to understand, had substantial professional experience with waiting. She invited him into her office. She closed the door behind him. She stayed by the door until he was sprawled out in his chair, and then she moved to sit down in her chair. She looked at him. He was waiting for her. "Look," she said. She was shaky. She wasn't shaky. Maybe her voice was shaky. She couldn't control it. "Let's talk about the tree." His immediate response was to take off his sunglasses, fold them up, and put them in his jacket pocket. She hated that. She wanted him to keep his sunglasses on. She didn't want to look him in the eye. He nodded at her. "You know plants, right?" This was justification. Rationalization. She understood exactly what she was doing. "Been working with them for 6,000 years, he said. He understood exactly what she was doing. What she was doing was wrong. She hated herself for it. "It's not doing well," she said. Her voice was shaking. "I know," he said. "You said it was blessed, didn't you? You said everything in here was blessed. Blessed more than anything had been for several centuries." That wasn't what he had said. They both knew that wasn't what he had said. This was wrong. "Shouldn't it be doing fine?" He smiled at her. It was a sad smile. It was a compassionate smile. "That's not how blessings work, I'm afraid. They give a leg up on certain things. I bet your tree hasn't had trouble finding good parking spots lately." This was ridiculous. "And I bet if it has suffered any injuries, it's been surprised how quickly it's healed. And also, if your tree bought a sheep, I bet it would find all its lambs would be completely free of spots." She frowned. "I know, that one hasn't been useful in a long time. Aziraphale really did pull out all the stops." She didn't have anything to say to that. "A blessing certainly doesn't make a tree invincible. Bad things will still happen to a blessed tree. Blessings don't keep trees from self-destructing, and they also aren't the final word when it comes to what happens after the tree dies. So you should be careful about that, too." This really was ridiculous. "What am I supposed to do?" she asked. "Get a specialist?" he offered. He made a gesture around the room. This room. He wasn't breaking the pretense, but he was making it clear what he meant. "I couldn't tell a specialist that..." She paused, trying to find the right words. Then she realized she didn't have to. "You know I couldn't talk to a specialist." He did know. She could see it in his eyes. He couldn't hide anything with his eyes uncovered. She could see the full extent of absolutely everything he was feeling. It was uncomfortable. Aziraphale? He suggested.
No, she said, quick and emphatic. He's harmless, I promise.
She shook her head.
No, it's not that.
It was that, but it was something else as well.
He's...
She pointed at him.
He's connected to you. It would be too complicated.
It's already complicated, he said. He didn't sound frustrated or demanding. She realized this was part of his professional competencies. He didn't demand. He really could be quite kind.
What she was doing was wrong.
Look, he said, changing tacks. You're an expert, right? You know how to do your job, so do your job. What would you do if you were your own client?
She shook her head.
If someone came in here with everything going on with you, what would you say to them?
I wouldn't even know where to start.
Sure you would.
His optimism was not infectious, but it was endearing.
My job isn't as easy as you seem to think it is, she said. Never said it was easy, just said you could do it.
She watched as he got an idea.
We can try it out.
She let him see she was suspicious.
I'll pretend to be you, he went on, and you'll be you, too. We'll both be you.
She rolled her eyes. He was starting to have fun, and she didn't like it.
I could put on your face, even, if you like. Impersonate your voice.
No! She was horrified. He grinned. He was teasing her.
Don't worry. I wouldn't.
He didn't say, I couldn't. He said, I wouldn't. She had to sit with that.
Come on. Humor me.
He shifted his posture in his chair, sitting upright. He changed the way he held his hands, the way he angled his head, the way his feet touched the floor even. She was impressed. He had skill. It was a little disturbing.
I'm Aubrey Time, he said, and he put on an American accent. He wasn't so good at that, which was a little reassuring,
although she wondered, perhaps he was doing it purposefully not well, just because it was reassuring. He was good at his job.
I'm not doing so well.
He looked at her, expectantly. Role-playing is a central component to any successful counseling training program. Every therapist in training spends countless hours role-playing with peers, taking turns being client and therapist. It is how the skills are honed. It is how the novice prepares to work with actual clients. It is, always, awkward and uncomfortable. When Aubrey Time had been a student, she had hated role-playing. Everyone else she knew hated it too, but they did it because it was important. Because it was how they learned to be professionals. It had been a number of years since she had last role-played a therapeutic encounter, but there was a sense memory to it, a familiarity. She had done this before. She was able to navigate the unpleasant awkwardness of a role-play. She could work through it because she remembered how to navigate it. All of this was thoroughly ridiculous.
Well, she said, half willing to play along.
Tell me what's going on. He had to think for a moment. She watched him as he thought.
I haven't actually said it out loud to anyone. I haven't said the words. I'm not sure it would be a good thing for me to hear someone else say the words before I've said them myself.
This is stupid, she said.
Uh-huh, sure. Sounds about right, he said, and he nodded his head, and goddamn, she wondered if it was equally annoying when she did that. Admittedly, she knew it was.
Humor me. She didn't want to say it. It was hard to say. She understood that meant she really did have to say it.
I've been drinking way too much lately.
He nodded his head. He smiled.
Thank you for telling me that. I really appreciate your bravery in saying that. This wasn't his role. He was supposed to be the client, and she the therapist. They had completely switched roles. No, they had confused them entirely. This wasn't a mirror image of what the therapeutic encounter should be. This was an inversion of how they should be. It was, instead, a complete annihilation of order, an obliteration of the very idea of structure. There weren't any rules to what they were doing. I've been in the middle of a complete existential crisis, she said. Hmm, he said, and he nodded again. Tell me about that. She couldn't help it. She let out a laugh. It had been a very long time since she had last laughed. Give me one emotion word, he said, and now he was really leaning in to making fun of her, and she could tell he was enjoying it. Just one. Adrift, she said. He considered. You count adrift as an emotion word? He used his own accent for that. Good enough, she said. Okay, adrift. Good one. He was back to his bad American accent now. Now, why do you think you feel adrift? Because, and it hit her that she hadn't said it before. She hadn't. He had been right about that. He hadn't played her role. He hadn't said it, because she was the one who needed to. If she was going to say it, she was going to say it. Because I found out that the world nearly ended a while ago, and I don't even remember it. I found out that heaven and hell are real, and God is real, and the other guy is real too. And one of my clients is a demon, and he's friends with an angel. And they turned my fake tree into a real one, and I don't know how to keep it alive. Wow, he said, and he said it exactly as she would have, and she rolled her eyes at him. She was starting to tear up, and rolling her eyes helped her hide it. He went on. That really is a lot. I bet any human would have trouble taking all that in. I wouldn't say human. You are not going to distract me with that. She rolled her eyes at him, more theatrically this time. She sniffed a little. He picked up the box of tissues on the table beside him, held it out to her. She hated this. She took a tissue and wiped at her eyes. Thank you for sharing that with me, Aubrey Time. He was looking at her. He was smiling at her with her own smile, her carefully crafted professional smile, which somehow fit on his face despite his two sharp teeth. It means a lot to me that you would be willing to share that with me. It doesn't make me any better, she said. She shrugged at him as a display of the nihilism she had been feeling for the past several months. But as she did it, she could also recognize it had a bit less of a hold on her. I'm not instantly healed. No, that's not how therapy works, he said, with a specific tone of voice she used when she offered psychoeducation like this. It's all a very slow process, but telling the truth is often the first step. And you're an expert, aren't you? You know how to take care of yourself. She said. You can talk to a mirror if I'm not around. She snorted. Take care of yourself, Herb. It was his accent, his inflection, his voice. He was looking at her. She watched him as he settled back into his customary sprawl. She watched as he settled back into his role as the client, which meant she was back to her role of the therapist. She crumpled the tissues up in her hand. I'm sorry, she said.
I'm a demon, he said.
You're good at what you do, she said.
So are you.
The good news, so far as Aubrey Time could see it, was that whatever mistakes occurred as part of a therapeutic encounter could be corrected. This was a central belief she had, and she could tell that her client, Crowley, understood it as well. Honest interaction with the therapeutic setting can undo past harms. The unflinching acceptance of compassionate truth-telling can mend a frayed relationship, no matter what. Even the worst fracture in the therapeutic alliance could be healed with enough honesty, compassion, and hard work. Who knows? Maybe she'd start going to AA. Although she rankled at all of their talk of a higher power. There were other support groups. She would find something. She could figure that all out on her own time. Right now, she was at work.
I mean,
Crowley was talking again. She could tell by his tone of voice he was going to throw a petty insult at her. He was going to throw a petty insult at her because that's what he did when he wanted to signal her that their therapeutic alliance was particularly strong.
I say you're good at your job, but then again, it is taking an awfully long time to get this blasted book finished, isn't it?
Uh-huh, sure, she said. She was accepting his banter.
And just move your tree over to the window. That's all it needs.
She thought, maybe she'd listen. Chapter 8. Protective Factors. There was something she had to do, and she had been putting it off. She had been putting it off because she didn't want to do it, because it was easier to put it off than to do it. She had put it off until the point when she felt like she couldn't safely put it off any longer. She had to do it before it was too late for her to do it right. "There's something I want to talk about before we get started," she said at the start of the session, after they had both sat down. "Just a heads up."
"Okay, sure," he said.
"I'm going to be unavailable for a month," she said.
"Oh,"
he said, and then he looked at her. There was this thing he did, the specific way he had of looking at her. When he did it, it felt like there was a warping to the room's air, like everything had grown just slightly too still, like he was purposefully restructuring the space between them. She didn't know if he actually was doing any of that. She didn't know if there was some sort of demonic thing or if she felt was just an emotional reaction to some subtle set of micro-expressions and shifts in his posture. She couldn't tell. All she knew was he had done this at some point or another in each session they had since they talked about the tree, and he did it on purpose. He did it, and he did it on purpose, and when he did it, she knew that he was saying, "I can see you, and I can listen." It set her teeth on edge every time he did it. It set her teeth on edge, and he must have known that it did, but he kept doing it anyway. The tree was over by the window these days. "We'll meet next week, and the week after that, and then we'll be taking a month-long break," she said.
"Sure.
We've never taken a break that long."
They had never taken a break at all. Aubrey Time wasn't one for vacations. "A month's not actually that long a time," he said, and then he added, "not for me."
"You might be surprised," she said. According to the triphasic model of trauma therapy, there are three different phases to trauma work. Not one of those phases, however, is the take-a-month-long-break phase. Not one of them is get halfway through processing the trauma and then leave your client for a full month phase. Not one of them is just go off and do fuck-all phase. And this, Aubrey Time knew, was because trauma processing wasn't the sort of thing you can just half-ass. It can be risky. Trauma sits in the brain, like an eternal and nightmarish actuality. And trauma processing requires working with that nightmare, confronting it, not ignoring it, but pushing on it. Trauma processing is not the sort of thing that a professional like Aubrey Time would want to get halfway through and then stop for a full month. Trauma processing is the sort of thing that a professional like Aubrey Time understood herself to have a duty to do properly, a duty that was vital to the safety and well-being of her clients. A professional like Aubrey Time would be able to keep fucking control of her life so she can do better than abandon her client halfway through processing his trauma. Any thoughts or feelings coming up, thinking about being away for a month? She asked. What about you? He was still looking at her. He was still doing the thing. This was part of their dynamic, when he was doing the thing. His honesty became currency. He held her to high prices. She shifted her eyes over to the tree. Just let them flick in that direction for a quick second. It wasn't an answer, but it was. I'm not going to ask where you're going, he said, like it was reassuring, like it was an expression of some shared ground rules. I didn't say I was going anywhere, she said, because it was reassuring, because it was an expression of her actual ground rules. And you didn't answer my question. Any thoughts or feelings about this? Nah, he said. Sounds good, actually. If Aubrey Time could, she would completely ban the words good and bad from Crowley's vocabulary. Sometimes he used good to mean bad, but also sometimes he used good to mean good, and sometimes he used bad to mean good, and other times he used it to mean bad. It was confusing. It got them stuck in pointless circles. We both know you need a break, he said after she hadn't responded, and he sounded a little hesitant. He sounded a little sad, and he also sounded like he was trying to hide it. It made her stomach clench. At least, though, he stretched out. He stopped doing the thing. We can talk more about it next week, and the week after that, she said, working to reinforce the timeline. For now, though, how about we get to work? Sure, he said. He got prepared, settled into his chair, getting comfortable. Aubrey Time had a plan, or at least part of one. She would have them work on the book today, and then they wouldn't the next session or the session after that. They would work on the book today, and she believed the chapter that they would work on would be good enough for her plan. It wasn't the best chapter for them to work on, not for her plan. If she had started planning earlier, she would have managed things so the last chapter they focused on before she abandoned him for a month was the Ritz, or retirement. But at least they weren't on the very central chapter, the fire, or after the fire. The chapter they were on, while not ideal, would give her what she needed for her plan to work. Or at least she felt reasonably assured it would. She knew the outline of events in Crowley's trauma narrative, at least in broad strokes. She knew the chapter that they set to work on today involved a disagreement between Crowley and Aziraphale. She also knew, from significant experience by this point, that just about every single story Crowley had to tell about himself and Aziraphale involved them disagreeing, bickering, snipping back and forth. She knew how he smiled when he told these stories, how he lit up, even as he acted frustrated and annoyed. She knew that he liked and admired Aziraphale's spunk, and that she thought was something she could plan around. For this session, as the last time they would work with the trauma narrative before she abandoned him for a month, Her plan was to focus on a section of the book which, she believed, would highlight Aziraphale's spunk. The loving dynamic they managed to maintain through gripes and huffy disputes. That was her plan. Okay, she said when she was ready to begin. Let's work on chapter 5, the bandstand. They got to work. After the hour was up and he had fleshed out the chapter, after he had recounted everything he remembered about what he had said and everything he remembered about what Aziraphale had said, after they had ended and he had left, Aubrey Time slumped down in her chair. Well, fuck, she thought. It had been a crap plan. As a general rule, psychotherapists do not approve of euphemism. Euphemism stands in the way of truth. It stands in the way of clarity. Euphemism comes with plausible deniability, and plausible deniability rarely has therapeutic value. Euphemism, in some certain circumstances, can be dangerous. What psychotherapists have in place of euphemism is technical terminology. They have a full language that allows them to discuss the most challenging topics with less pain than those topics deserve. They know what they mean when they use their technical terminology. And they also know that the technical terminology can, sometimes, make it easier to discuss what they need to discuss with one another. They all understand the very practical implications of the painful topics they have to discuss. They give themselves the comfort of technical terminology because they know, for some topics, they need all the comfort they can get. What they talk about is risk. An individual's risk falls on a scale between low and high. There is no one who is zero risk. There is no client in any circumstance who is deemed to be completely free of risk. Everyone, at all times, is at least low risk. What psychotherapists do is complete risk assessments. They do this by asking questions which have none of the euphemisms, none of the safety provided by the technical terminology. They ask questions that are blunt and direct because these are the questions that allow them to establish a client's level of risk. The questions they ask are, do you ever think of killing yourself? Have you in the past? Do you ever think of hurting or killing others? Have you in the past? They ask these questions because it is their job to ask these questions. They ask these questions because they need to know the answers, because it is their duty, above all else, to protect their clients' lives. They ask these questions and they take them seriously because there are so many for whom the answer is yes. The fact that someone answers yes to any of those questions does not mean that they are high risk. Suicidal ideation, thoughts of one's own death, are in fact fairly common. Answering yes to these questions does not mean that the client is in crisis, another not euphemism, another way of describing something terrifying and all too common for a professional therapist. Answering yes, instead, simply leads to a variety of additional questions, and one's answers to those questions determines where one falls in terms of risk. Clients do not always take the risk assessment questions seriously. They do not want to take them seriously. Some clients do not want to believe that those questions could be relevant to themselves, and others do not want to have to give them truthful answers. So they joke. They give silly, funny answers, as if the topic could be funny, as if their answers couldn't actually matter, as if it would never even occur to them that their therapist would have to take even those jokey, silly answers seriously. They joke and they have fun because they haven't had to sit with a client in crisis. They haven't lost a client to pointless death. They haven't spent months or years in therapy of their own, trying to look back and figure out how they had failed someone in their care so seriously. When Aubrey Time first sat down with Crowley, that first session they spent together, when he had asked about Oedipus and she had taught him a grounding technique, she had performed their risk assessment. She had asked her questions, blunt and to the point, and he had not joked. He had not laughed. He had taken the questions seriously. He had taken the questions seriously, and he had lied through his teeth about them. She had been able to tell that he was lying about the answers. She had pushed him on it, gently, carefully, because they had not formed a therapeutic alliance yet, because he had been so angry and untrusting back then. But she had pushed him, and he had kept lying. There comes a point when someone is lying to you, when there is nothing you can do but accept their lies. She had put him at low risk. For a client who is low risk, a therapist might not even ask those blunt questions again. But risk assessment was never a one-and-done sort of thing. Risk assessment begins with blunt and awkward questions, and then it continues regularly, session after session, through a variety of careful observations and less direct inquiries. Aubrey Time still put Crowley at low risk. At least, Aubrey Time put Crowley at low risk for suicidality. Homicidal ideation was a completely different matter. She supposed that she could successfully count him as a low risk of homicidality, given that he never presented any realistic fantasies about harming specific identifiable humans. She was willing to accept that. That was perhaps the best that she could ask for a demon. The fact that, from Aubrey Time's professional opinion, Crowley was low risk did not leave her too reassured in light of her upcoming month-long absence. She thought perhaps it should leave her more reassured. She thought perhaps that the growing concerns she had about him, along with all the rest of her clients, said more about her own control issues than anything going on with their actual risk levels. But still, she wasn't reassured. Related to an individual's level of risk were the client's risk factors. There were certain factors to an individual's personality, life history, and external circumstances that make it statistically more likely that he will kill himself. And Crowley, for his part, had a variety of risk factors. The biggest one, in Aubrey Time's professional opinion, was his impulsivity. Anthony J. Crowley had an impulsive streak a mile wide. He was impulsive, and he was prone to fits of despair, and he was halfway through the painful and distressing process of working through his trauma narrative. And it just so happens that the mixture of pain and distress in someone with an impulsive streak a mile wide, who is also prone to fits of despair, could be very, very bad. Still, Crowley was low risk. Along with his risk factors, he also had a significant protective factor, or something that lowered the statistical likelihood that he would hurt himself. It was preferable, of course, for an individual to have a wide variety of distinct protective factors, but Crowley was different. Crowley may have had only one significant protective factor, but the protective factor he had was the most powerful fucking thing Aubrey Time had ever encountered. Crowley was low risk, and she believed he would likely remain low risk so long as the whole of his life could stay comfortably curled around Aziraphale. All she wanted to do, all she wanted before she left him on his own for a whole goddamn month, was to reinforce the meaningfulness and significance of his connection to Aziraphale as much as possible. Let him lean into Aziraphale fully and completely, and she could feel safe leaving him for a full month. There is no such thing as no risk. There's only ever low risk. Her plan had been a crap plan. It would have been a better plan, less prone to failure, if she hadn't put off talking to him about her impending time away for so long. And now she only had 2 sessions to come up with something better. "I've got a handout for you today," she said at the start of the next session.
"Oh," he said.
There had been a time where she would have interpreted that as a sarcastic response, but she knew better by now. She knew, by now, just how much Crowley enjoyed handouts. He loved them. He loved that sometimes they had typographical errors. And then he could hold up the handout and point them out to her until he had completely pissed her off. He loved that sometimes they were printouts of scans and photocopies, and he could pretend not to be able to read the words on the page. He loved that sometimes the images didn't line up with the text. One time, a handout had been in Comic Sans, and that had made his whole day. Aubrey Time did not make these handouts. She never would have chosen Comic Sans. She didn't make typographical errors. He still loved giving her grief about it, though. "You're really going to like this one," she said, hamming it up, knowing just what cards she had in her deck. "It's from a self-help book." "Ooh," he said, even more enticed. "Sounds horrible." She was holding the handout upside down, so he couldn't see it. She handed it over to him, upside down as well. He could only see what the handout was once it was in his hands and he had flipped it over. "Oh, this is shit," he pronounced with dismay as soon as he saw what it was. But it was too late. It was already in his hands. He was stuck with it now. "I know," she said, and she couldn't help but grin. She couldn't help but grin because it really was shit. And maybe she hammed it up a bit more than necessary because she knew she would get that reaction from him. "We're going to talk about it anyway." The Five Love Languages was published in 1992. It was, in Aubrey Time's professional opinion, just as it apparently was in Crowley's, shit. It was crap. It was bullshit. It was not, in her opinion, the lowest of the low of self-help nonsense, but it was pretty low. However, she also knew sometimes even bullshit could be helpful. Sometimes, when you've got a pesky nail to deal with, you just need any hammer. Not necessarily a good one. "So, what is it?" he asked, putting no effort into reading it at all. "It's just a way of describing how some people go about expressing their feelings for those they care about." "Love," the handout said. The word used was love, but she didn't say that. "Different people express how much they care for each other in different ways." The best element of the 5 love languages, in Aubrey Time's professional opinion, was the accuracy of the title. You're promised 5 love languages, and that's exactly how many you got. The 5 languages were words of affirmation, gift giving, acts of service, quality time, physical touch. "Some people," she continued, "are really good at showing how much they care about someone in one of these ways, but not in others. And sometimes someone might not even realize that someone else is trying to show how much they care because the two of them expect care to be expressed in different ways. Go ahead, look it over." She gave him a pointed look until he gave in and started reading. This was one of the more professionally designed handouts she had, unfortunately, which meant there weren't any typos for him to find. It wasn't as fun as he had hoped. "All right," he said, resigned, and he leaned back a bit in his chair. "I know what you're getting at."
"Oh, yeah? What's that?"
"Me and Aziraphale."
"Uh-huh,"
she said, using the full extent of her professional skills to bite back the "no duh" that had settled in her throat. "So, what do you think about it?" He shrugged. It was either a thoughtful shrug or a bored one. The two states could be remarkably similar for him. "Can you recognize yourself in any of those?" she asked. He gave in. He actually started considering the different languages described. He made small clicking noises with his tongue as he looked them over. "Don't know," he said, still looking at his options. "Maybe all of them? Maybe none? Can't tell." "Are you fucking kidding me?" she thought. "It can be subtle sometimes," she said. "Words of affirmation are right out." He got that right, at least. "Look, there's a quiz you can take." It wasn't an assessment. It wasn't a screening. It wasn't a test. It was a quiz, for fuck's sake. But she could sweeten the pot. "Oprah took it live on TV once." Oh. His tastes, while not simple, were at least remarkably predictable. She already had it, ready to go on her end table. She handed it to him, along with a clipboard and a pen. She watched as he took it, as he counted up his score, as he looked at the results. "Huh," he said. "Acts of service," she said. He hadn't shown her his score, but really, come on. "I suppose." "Mm-hmm." "And then there was that time." "Mm-hmm." "And I..." He stopped himself, looking up. "You're not surprised?" "Crowley," she said, and she couldn't help but laugh a little. "I don't know how you could be any more obvious." He seemed to accept that. "What do you think Aziraphale is?" "You know him better than I do. What do you think?" He ended up taking the quiz again. But this time, he had imagined what Aziraphale would say. "He got a tie," Crowley said, when he was finished, sounding offended by the results. "Both acts of service and quality time." "That happens sometimes." "It did. The quiz was bullshit. Does that sound right to you?" He didn't respond, because he was thinking. He was thinking, and his face was turned downward, like he was confused, like he didn't know what to think. He was thinking, and she was starting to worry that his thinking wasn't going the way she wanted it to. She decided to direct. "Can you come up with any examples where he showed you how he cared about you in one of those ways?" Now his brow was furrowed. Now his lips pursed. He wasn't looking towards her. He was looking away. "Well, fuck," she thought. She'd try a different route. "Maybe you can share with me some of the ways you've shown him how you care for him over the years." "Where's my book?" he asked, suddenly intent. And no, that was not okay. "I wanted to put off working on it until I got back." "Fine, but let me see it." She didn't want to let him see it. "Can I ask why?" she asked, trying to sound uncommitted. "I just want to see it." "Yes, but why?" "It's my book. Let me see it." He was getting agitated now. He was starting to fidget, and his expression had hardened. She didn't want him to see the book, but she also didn't want him to grow upset. "How about I get the book, but I keep hold of it?" "Fine, sure." She stood, moved to the filing cabinet where she kept it, and she got it out. She brought it back, sat down with it. She held it in her lap, working to limit his view of it. "Okay," he said, leaning forward, wanting access to his half-done trauma narrative. "Read back to me what we did last time." "I don't think that's a good idea." "No, it's fine," he said, a bit too quickly for it to really be fine. "I'm just curious. Just read it back to me." She frowned at him. What had left her most worried about their last session was his effect as they had worked through the bandstand. What he had recounted must have hurt. It must have. But he denied it. He denied any distress, and he expressed none either. That was what had left her most worried. If he had cried, if he had screamed, if he had given any indication that they had access to the deep pain that he must be associating with the bandstand, she would have been less worried. She could control his pain if he experienced it in a session with her. She could not control it if it came out anywhere other than her office. She especially could not control it if it came out while she was gone for a whole fucking month. "It's my book, Herb. Come on," he insisted. She considered her options. If she refused, then that would be the whole rest of the session. He would be angry, she would be angry, and she would have no chance of getting his attention back where she wanted it. If she relented, on the other hand, then there was a strong likelihood that this session would not be the easy, light-hearted session she wanted. Perhaps, however, he would get to feel the strong emotions he had denied last time, and then she would be a bit reassured. Additionally, she thought, if she was very careful and just a bit lucky, she could actually pull the conversation back to where she wanted it. It was worth a shot. "Okay, you win," she sighed out. She flipped through the papers until she found the work that they had done for the bandstand. She gave him one final look of warning, and he gestured to hurry her along. So she read, "Xerophale and I met up at the bandstand," she read out loud. "I wanted him to go to Alpha Centauri with me. He wanted to go too. I told him I'd make sure he was safe. I told him we would both be safe out there. I told him that if he couldn't trust me after all this time, then what was even the point? The world was ending, and I just wanted to keep him safe. I told him that we were on our own side, not either of the other two." She paused there. She looked up to him. He looked like he was concentrating. Crowley hated his book. She knew he hated it. He hated that she wouldn't let him include any actual goddamn sonnets, but also wouldn't let him turn it into a joke. He hated that she wouldn't let him rip it into shreds whenever he grew frustrated. He hated all of it, and she knew this. He looked, currently, like he was too distracted to pay attention to how much he hated it. That was worrisome. "You know," she offered, soft and quiet, trying to pull his attention where she wanted it, "especially after what we've talked about today, I can hear in these words just how much you care for him." He wasn't listening. "Keep going," he said. "I think it's the next bit." Yes, it was the next bit. Of course it was the next bit. It was the next bit that she really didn't want to read. He made the gesture again to hurry her up. She frowned at him again, but she returned to reading out loud. "He said he didn't like me. He said he never appreciated any of the things I'd ever done for him. He said that he'd rather spend eternity with Michael and Gabriel and even that sadistic prick Sandalphon than admit that he ever liked me. He told me it was over, that he wasn't on my side, and he'd never go anywhere with me ever again." She stopped there. The chapter continued, but she suspected that that was the bit that he cared about. He didn't push her to go on. He was sitting very still, and his brow was furrowed deep, and his mouth was working. "Talk to me, Crowley." He just shook his head. "Come on," she said, her voice professional and calm and supportive. "Deep breaths. Stay with me." She watched him as he took the deep breaths. She watched him as he moved his face to the side. His eyes were covered, but she could imagine how they were searching around the room, searching for something to latch onto. "Tell me what you're thinking," she said. "Maybe," he started. He shook his head again. His mouth worked some more before any more words came out. "Maybe he didn't actually say any of that." "That's a real possibility." It was more than a possibility, in her opinion. She had, in fact, put a little asterisk next to sadistic prick as a reminder to go back sometime and ask him if Aziraphale would actually say something like that. She doubted, however, that those words were what Crowley was so concerned over. Trauma affects our memory systems. It was normally a bad idea for her to say something like, our memory systems, in a session with him. As Aubrey Time now knew, she and Crowley had a substantial disagreement about neurology. He had insisted he had none. She insisted, for her part, that he displayed consistent and predictable patterns of behavior which were perfectly in accord with the assumptions that he had, at least, central, sympathetic, and parasympathetic nervous systems matching those of a human. They had agreed to disagree. And today, for this, with how preoccupied he was, she thought perhaps she could rely on their unsteady truce.
I don't think he would have actually said any of that, he said.
He sounded far off and scared. He sounded like he wanted to be able to convince himself.
I know he said things. I know he did. But I can't remember now if he said those specific things.
She repositioned herself on her seat so she was leaning a bit closer to him. Both of them were now leaning in towards each other. He needed connection. He said something, and it hurt, and this is how your memory recorded it, she offered.
And I know I left some things out, he went on,
and she wasn't sure if he had even heard her. He pulled off his sunglasses so he could squeeze his eyes shut and rub at them with his hands.
I remember I told him I'm unforgivable. I remember that clear as day. I said to him, unforgivable, that's what I am. I left that out last time, didn't I?
Yeah, you did.
But why would I have said that?
He opened his eyes now and he looked at her. And he wanted so badly for her to be able to give him the answer.
I can't remember why I said that. I can't. What could he have said to me so I would say that to him?
She couldn't say. She hadn't been there. The only beings who had been there had been both angry and upset, hurt and scared, suffering trauma.
He knows I'm unforgivable. Of course he does. It really is what I am. So what would have led me to saying any of that?
He was starting to repeat himself. She took that as a cue. She modeled deep breathing for him, and then she spoke. You know, Crowley, since his sunglasses were off, she could seek out his eye contact. That would help him stay focused on her rather than get lost back in his looping thoughts. We like to think that the memory is like a camera, like it just records footage, and we can go back and rewatch it whenever we want, exactly how it happened. He didn't see the connection to his situation. She could see the confusion threading through his pained expression. It's not like that, though. What we remember is a big mix of what really happened and also what we felt like was happening and what we feel about it after the fact, too. He nodded. He was starting to follow. His mouth hung open and he turned his eyes away from her. We can't know what he actually said. We're not... She had almost said, we're not omniscient, but she didn't want to know what she would find inside that can of worms. We're not going to know. What we do know, though, is that this is what you remember, regardless of what really happened. I think this tells us how you were feeling when it happened. She gave him some time to think about that. 20 seconds, he thought about that. Let me ask you this, she said, knowing she was interrupting his thoughts. It was worth doing so because she was still working towards her goal. You wrote here that he said he didn't appreciate the things you've done for him. We can interrogate that, whether he said it or not. We can interrogate if it's true. How's that sound? His eyes turned back to her. He was listening. Does Aziraphale appreciate the things you do for him? She watched as his jaw set. It didn't set in anger or frustration or pain. Instead, it set with what looked like pure certainty. He nodded his head. Do you think he always has?
Always,
he said. She could see tears starting to well in his eyes. That's wonderful, she said, and she let her voice express that she meant it. She smiled. She smiled at him. And let me ask you this. Does he invite you to spend time with him?
Always,
he said again, and he nodded his head, and he lifted a hand to wipe a tear from his eyes. Give me some examples, she said, because she wanted him to list them. She wanted them to be fresh in his mind. He paused for a moment to collect his thoughts and to wipe at his eyes again. Crowley, she knew, was almost never willing to take a tissue.
He's always inviting me places. Ever since Rome, he invited me to lunch. I've always been welcome in the bookshop.
He likes picnics. She heard that pause, and she felt she understood what that meant. She felt she understood what it meant because she knew plenty about Crowley's and Aziraphale's habits. She knew that when Aziraphale invited him to do, more than anything else, was drink wine and get drunk and then drink even more. And she would have been annoyed, deeply annoyed, to think that Crowley had thought to censor himself during a moment like this. She would have been annoyed, but she had work to do. So you see, she offered, and she ensured her voice was soft and high. She ensured that her voice took on a tone of hope. What do you think all this means? He didn't answer right away. He was busy. He was busy with the challenging task of feeling what mattered, of experiencing how much there was for him to feel. It means, he said when he could, because he had not forgotten her question, that he's my whole world. Yes, she agreed. She nodded in agreement. She chuckled slightly, and it was a compassionate, happy sound. Exactly. And let me ask this. Are you his whole world? She could see it, the very instant those words registered with him. She could see it because it was like a blow to him. The words registered in his body, in his shoulders, and his stomach, and his lungs. They registered like pain, like sorrow, like horror. They registered like that for him because the answer was obvious. The answer was obvious, and he couldn't deny it, and it hurt for him to acknowledge it was true.
Yes,
he said, and he was shaking. And he was the broken little child she so often saw him as.
Yes, I am.
It shouldn't hurt to be the subject of unconditional love. It shouldn't hurt, but it often does for those who have experienced trauma, especially those who have experienced early life trauma at the hands of a parent. It hurts because trauma situates itself in the brain, and it stays there, and it makes fear and horror and pain feel normal, and it makes love and acceptance and protection feel like a threat. Early life trauma inverts the world, inverts one's instincts, makes one feel safe when confronted with danger, and endangered when confronted with safety. Early life trauma, especially at the hands of a parent, could deprive you from the sense of love. It could leave you capable of appreciating and understanding and wanting to be loved, but incapable of truly feeling it, of letting it in, of getting to rejoice in it and sing its praises. Aubrey Time understood what Crowley was experiencing. She understood it as the professional she was. She understood it. For the whole rest of the session, he didn't do the thing, from the first time since the tree, she wasn't confronted with the thing. And when he left, Aubrey Time felt just a little bit more relaxed, a bit safer, a bit less at risk. One more session to go. Thank you so much for listening. That was chapters 5-8 of Demonology and the Triphasic Model of Trauma, an Integrative Approach, written by NNM. These chapters specifically feel like a good time to mention that if you found that you related to any of the descriptors of being high risk or in crisis, or the identifiers for alcohol substance abuse, please don't be afraid to reach out to a friend or therapist. There are also a bunch of phone numbers posted on the main page for this fic, so please look those over and never be afraid to give one of them a call if you need to. Suicide is never the right answer. About this fic, though, as you likely already know, there are 16 chapters in total, so please check back for the forthcoming chapter recordings. If you can't wait and would like to access the written version of this story, you can read it at archiveofourown.org/works/20177950. I'm Starcatcher Betty, and thanks again for listening. I hope you enjoyed.